Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norma Walden, a program coordinator of the Club's International Relations Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker today, Herman Pirchner Jr., became the founding president of the American Foreign Policy Council in 1982. Before that, he had served in the U.S. Senate on the staffs of two Iowa senators, Roger Jepson and Chuck Grassley. The American Foreign Policy Council, under Mr. Pirchner's leadership, has hosted Washington events for hundreds of foreign officials, conducted hundreds of briefings for members of Congress, and organized dozens of fact-finding missions abroad for senior American officials. Herman Pirchner's travels have taken him to most areas of the world, especially to the territory of the former Soviet Union, where he has visited more than 65 times since 1989. In 2005, he published Reviving Greater Russia, The Future of Russia's Borders with Belarus, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Moldova, and Ukraine. Please help me welcome Herman Pirchner Jr., to tell us why Russia and Ukraine fight.
Norma, thank you so much, and thank you especially for your great care in helping this forum be organized. I know my staff really enjoyed working with you. So she's really professional, was the word that came back, so thank you. This is a map of Ukraine, and here's Crimea. Without Crimea, Russian-financed, equipped, directed forces also occupy about a third of these two provinces. You often think when you hear about the Russians in the east and the Ukrainians in the west, it's down the center. It's not. And I'm going to switch to this map, which I'm going to leave up. These are those two provinces. That's a full Ukraine here. And these are the two provinces where the fighting is going on. This is the area that the Russian supported and backed and directed troops occupy. And the rest is controlled by Kiev forces. So far, 10,000 people have been killed, many times that number wounded, and 1.5 million or more refugees created as a result of the fighting. And though the Ukraine war does not occupy the front pages of papers anymore, fighting goes on in spite of agreements to stop it. Ceasefire agreements are continually broken. Virtually every day there are 50, 100, 150 violations of the ceasefire, and people continue to die. When it does appear in the newspapers, I note they're often very bad facts. And some of this is the result of what Russians call disinformatsiya, which is literally means disinformation. They are masters, really, about putting bad facts into Western press and the press of other countries to improve global interpretations of what's going on in Ukraine, and also to show enough doubt in Western minds that there is not a firm response. But I don't want to talk about Russian propaganda. After all, it's an accepted tool of war, and many countries use it in wartime, probably not as effectively as Russia had. This talk will really be about why that war is going on, why Russia has chosen its aggressive posture, and why Ukraine chooses to fight. I think there are three major reasons why that drive Russia's policy. The first really is common to all failed empires. In the year of 1900, there were only 55 sovereign countries in the world. Now there are 190-some, depending on how you count. Where did all these new countries come from? They came from the collapse of the 13 empires that dominated the world of 1900. And upon collapse, every last one of them had one thing in common. And that is reestablishing influence in their former territories. Mostly was done for economic reasons and mostly peacefully. But even democracies such as France used force, I counted once, 40 times trying to protect their economic assets in Africa. If a regime was coming to power in Africa they didn't like, they'd send in the Foreign Legion to topple it. So in this sense, one could expect that when Russia got stronger, it would put pressure on its former territories, especially since they were contiguous. A second thing driving Russian policy is the question of nationalism. At the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, when you had a Duma, that's a Russian parliament, that was more or less freely elected in a real debate, they gave the floor to the famed anti-communist Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And Solzhenitsyn, in addition to being anti-communist, was very much a Russian nationalist. And his whole speech was upon the need now to create a greater Slavic state. That means Belarus, means Ukraine, that means northern Kazakhstan. And the fact that he was given that forum to deliver this message already indicated widespread support within the Russian population for the renewed expansion of Russian territory. A little bit later in that decade, a man by the name of Dmitry Rogozin wrote a work from which I'll soon quote. Rogozin was associated with General Lebed, now dead, later a National Security Advisor of Russia. And Lebed was in charge of the army that helped the Russian breakaway region of Moldova called Transnistria. And it's really one of these frozen conflicts. I met Rogozin first in the mid-90s, where he outlined his nationalist views, which really haven't changed. But let me read you a little bit from his book, which was published in the mid-90s. The book's We Will Reclaim Russia for Ourselves. He says, the lack of understanding of the Russian question, the division of the Russian nation, gives us the feeling of an unrepaid debt, and debts must be repaid. Russians should discuss out loud the problem of a divided people that has an historic right to political unification of its own land. We Russians must present ourselves with the problem of a union, no matter how unrealistic this idea is in today's conditions. This is mid-90s. And we must create the conditions to result in the environment with which Germany dealt with for 40 years, coming out united in the end. So this was his aspiration and is his aspiration. He's now deputy prime minister, and if Putin ever falls, he's a possible successor. The problem with this, as we'll discuss later, is this is an unrequited love. He may see it as all one great Russian people, a greater Slavic nation, but there are rather different ideas in Ukraine. As I said, we'll get to that later. But it wasn't just that these ideas were being promoted in the 90s, but as Russia became a little bit stronger, concrete steps began to be taken to make the expansion of the Russian territory a reality. I think especially in the year 2001, when the Duma passed into law a law that provided for the territorial expansion of the Russian Federation. And that was a law whose provisions were followed when Crimea was annexed. I have a copy of it here if anybody would like to see it after the talk. We, at the American Foreign Policy Council, I think we provided the first English language translation. If somebody is a native Russian reader, I can have that sent from Washington. We kept the original text. And 2 years later, the Secretary of the Minister of Defense of Russia promulgated a doctrine that Russia reserved the right to protect Russian nationals in third countries. And remember, the raison d'etre for Russia going into this part of Ukraine is maybe the Russian nationals weren't properly treated. And that's been a drumbeat inside the Russian Federation. And many Russians, having only the source of state media, believe to greater or lesser extent many things about the territory of Ukraine that simply aren't true. I was, for instance, in, I'll go back to the other map, Kharkiv some months ago, which is the second largest city of Ukraine. It's Russian speaking. And but they are with Kiev, not Russia for the most part. And I asked them about their conversations with friends that live in Russia, because there's a great deal of intermarriage. There's people that have work colleagues. There are ethnic Ukrainians, of course, that still live on the territory of Russia. And this is what they told me. So it's very frustrating. I call up my sister or my brother that lives inside of Russia, and I tell them there's no problem with me speaking the Russian language, and they don't believe me. They can't believe they're being lied to that much. And it's certainly a measure of the effectiveness of internal Russian propaganda that the state news media becomes a more trusted source than your own brother or sister. Over time, of course, that will wear away as more people travel back and forth. But in the short term, it's been extremely potent. But the main point to come back to is that Russia was beginning to prepare for the time when they would try to regain the territory of Ukraine. They tried to elect Yanukovych the first time and failed because of the Orange Revolution. The official results from the first round of electing the pro-Russian Yanukovych was that he won, but the fraud was so massive that there was a revolt, a new election, and Yushchenko came to power. But finally, there was another election because Yushchenko had a lot of problems with his presidency, and Yanukovych was legitimately elected. And when he was elected, he began to do things that aided in the preparation for Russia to take more of Ukraine. And among those, without doing an hour speech on everything he did, were the opening of five Russian consulates. And these consulates became the base for Russian covert operations to lay the groundwork for the takeover of Crimea, for the advances made in Luhansk and Donetsk, and for things that were tried in other cities like Kharkiv and Odessa. Being in Crimea a couple years before the fighting began and the Russian takeover began, I had a chance to talk to one of these consul generals. This is a man you would expect normally to be an ambassador in a big country, and he's in little Crimea, a couple million people. What was he doing there? We know now pretty well that he would be contacting pro-Russian people, and there are pro-Russian people in Crimea. He would give them money to organize. He would make alliances with mafia types that now have benefited from people fleeing Crimea so they could take over the abandoned territory. In other words, laying the groundwork for the time when Russia could make a move to take back Crimea. And the reason I talk about these things is that there's an idea that it was simply because of the toppling of Yanukovych. It was simply about a trade deal with Europe or NATO expansion. No, the idea of reunifying the Slavic parts of the former Soviet Union was there a long time. Concrete plans were laid, and only the toppling of Yanukovych and the Maidan provided the opportunity to put these plans into action. The third thing I think that is driving Russian policy inside of Ukraine has to do specifically with Vladimir Putin and his own vulnerabilities at home. Putin has said on many occasions that it's common statecraft to have foreign adventurism to take attention away from problems at home. And he's not the only person that said that, and he's not the only leader that's followed this course. But I note that he is now head of a country that's running out of currency reserves, which will happen sometime next year, where the standard of living has gone down 10% in recent years, where you have the best and brightest of young Russians leaving because they don't have faith in Russia's future under Putin. You have a man that increasingly the public understands he and the elite at the top have stolen and stripped state assets. And when they steal these billions of dollars, this is Putin and the big people around him. Do they invest in Russia? No, large amounts of it, and the families go to London, to Paris, to Cyprus, to other places. And why? Because they themselves don't have faith in the future of Russia. There are other problems. Life expectancy of a Russian male, 60 years of age. That's third world quality. So, and apart from the economic questions I mentioned, you have problems of internal rivalries. Some people in the military are not happy with a campaign that now siphons huge amounts of money to support these territories and that has stalled because of bad information. What do I mean by bad information? We had a famous World War II general, Beadle Smith, later CIA director, but in between, for 3 years, 47 to 50, he was a U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union. And he wrote a book called My 3 Years in Moscow. And in it, the thing that scared him the most was that the Russians, the Soviets, would begin to believe their own propaganda. Well, part of the adventurism into eastern Ukraine after taking Crimea was so easy was the fact that everybody was telling lies on up the chain to Putin and his cadre about how much support Russia had here and how disgusted the Ukrainian people were with the government and what was going on. It turned out, for reasons we'll talk about later, simply not to be true. But at the time they went in, it was widely believed that Nova Russia would become annexed to Moscow, and that would be a territory that roughly goes in the area I'm sweeping over with my hand. For those of you on radio, it would cover the eastern provinces of Ukraine and go southeast to Odessa and perhaps to Transnistria, which is that breakaway province of Moldova I talked about. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen because Putin was misinformed. At any rate, Putin feeling threatened at home, and he's not as popular as would be believed, probably feels some need for adventurism in Ukraine, in Syria, for the threatening of the Baltic states, and even his brinksmanship that's been shown with the Scandinavian states interfering with their air defense zone and with their territorial waters. So this is how what's driving things from Russia. But what about the view from Ukraine? Ukraine, for 400 years, was territorially the largest country in Europe. At this time, Moscow was nothing, Russia was nothing. You had in the 13th century the Mongol invasion, and for a little more than 100 years, the Mongols ruled. Finally pushed out by the Polish-Lithuanian Empire that ruled part of all of present-day Ukraine, until the partitions of Poland, especially the third partition in 93 and the final partition in 95. This is when Poland disappeared from the map with Germany invading from one side and Tsarist Russia from the other. Throughout this entire time, the Ukrainian language stayed intact, the culture stayed intact, and the ethnic identity stayed intact. And this continued during the Tsarist period, where a great effort was made to bring all the churches under the rule and the guidance of the Moscow Patriarchy to convert the Eastern Rite Catholics to Eastern Orthodoxy under the Moscow Patriarchy. There was repression of the language. You couldn't publish during part of this time in the Ukrainian language. There wasn't instruction, but the Ukrainian ethnic identity still survived. It became, though, even worse under Soviet times. In the early 30s, something happened called the Holodomor. What was the Holodomor? Ukraine, like the U.S. then, was largely a rural country. And the villages of the most anti-communist, the most Ukrainian nationalists, were surrounded by the KGB of the time, MGB. And they took the food out, and they wouldn't let people come in or out. So between 2 and 4 million people were starved to death between 2 and 4 million. If you go into Kiev, there's this enormous memorial to this, but we have one in Washington, D.C., passed by a bipartisan act, enabled by a bipartisan act of Congress. It exists within about 2 blocks of the Capitol, between Union Station, if you know Washington, and a pub called the Dubliner, memorial to this forced famine. A few years later came the height of the repression under Stalin, where many were killed, more were taken to the gulags. Well, who is running Russia today? It's the KGB successor organizations. Who is running Ukraine today? The grandchildren, the nieces, the nephews of people that were starved to death. And these are stories that they heard when they were very young. And they simply don't want a repeat for that. After all this time of maintaining the Ukrainian language, the ethnic identity, and having suffered under various forms of imperialism, they really want their own country. And this is why when the Russian forces began fighting here, with very little support, they went to the front. And when I say very little support at the beginning, let me tell you how it was. The Ukrainian army had largely been destroyed under the pro-Russian, now deposed leader Yanukovych. So what the defense was from self-funded militias that were funded by businessmen and people. And to join the militia, individual kids in their teens or 20s had to go out and raise $1,000. Now, let me put that in perspective. You retire as an old person in Ukraine or $200 or $300 a month. And they had to go and collect it, and this bought the uniform, this got them a rifle, and maybe only a dozen bullets, and no training, and they went to the front. And the rest went to rehab old World War II tanks and weapons and artillery that had been mothballed. And you saw even though it's a very corrupt country, nobody thought that money was being siphoned out. It all went to the war effort. You know, when you go in a country and you want to figure out what's going on, you have to talk to the officials, but officials in any country will spin you. And if you travel a lot of times, you'll understand some are more reliable than others, and some are even good prognosticators. But if you get down and talk to the average people, you have a better sense. And when I travel to Ukraine and other countries, I do that. And one conversation especially sticks in my mind. There was a hospice whose head nurse was married to a friend of mine. They're Ukrainian-born. And I spent an evening in their home talking to her. And this hospice took in the most severely wounded from the front. And let me tell you something. If you're a 19-year-old kid and you don't know if you're going to live, you have honest conversations with your nurse. So she knew. And what she told me was these kids, some of them survived the burns. If they could, they went back. And because they simply, even they knew the risk, they knew they weren't trained, they knew they were outgunned, because they weren't going to give up to the Russians. So this is a type of spirit you have, and we'll get into the current military condition a little later. But this is why, unexpectedly, the offense stalled and at some point began to be rolled back. And only when it was rolled back and Russian reinforcements came in, officially not Russian, but they were Russian military and Russian equipment to get to the line of control, the ceasefire line you see today. So this is the main thing driving Ukraine, but there's another thing that I think is especially important to think about, and that is how the young people view their future. At the time of independence of Ukraine, when the Soviet Union broke up, Poles and Ukrainians lived exactly the same in terms of per capita income. Now the Poles live literally 3-plus times better, especially if you're in the western part of the country, where it's easy to get into Poland. There's a lot of back and forth, and you know, and the younger people say, why can't I live like this? So they have a vision of a more Western economy and Western standard of life. And even if you're in the East, you know people, you have access to internet, you have access to TV, and their aspirations to move towards the West, which is what the new Ukrainian government is attempting to do. but maybe even more poignant when you're talking about ethnic Russians and Russian speakers in the East. They're seeing how the territory is being administered here and in Crimea, and it's a pretty ugly sight. The security forces, I'm going to change maps on you again. Security forces in these areas have taken back the Soviet name of the KGB, MGBUR. Remember, these are the ones that did the gulags. This is name used when you had the forced famine. And there are pictures of Stalin coming up. And this is extremely unnerving, not just to Ukrainians, but to ethnic Russians. It's a basket case. Russia's funding the military activity, but if you're a civilian in these territories, you're having an extremely rough time because you're not being properly supported. And additionally, as I think I alluded to earlier, a de facto alliance has been made with the separatist forces and some of the local mafia people. This may be especially true in Crimea. You drive out the Ukrainians or into Tartars in Crimea, and who inherits the territory. So there's an economic dimension to it too. So I'm not going to tell you that every Russian speaker, ethnic Russian in Ukraine is in favor of Kiev. They're not, but there's enough of a majority that the oblasts are staying with Kiev. It's important to know, by the way, at the time of independence, every single Ukrainian province voted for independence, including in Crimea. I think it was close, 52-48 or something like that, but that's how the vote was. So where does this leave us today? In the last couple years, Ukrainian army has become far more professional. They build up substantial defenses, and if you would have a renewed Russian invasion, Russia is strong enough, they could invade and take more land. But the problem for Putin is that he's never leveled with his own people about what he's doing in eastern Ukraine. And that works as long as you don't have a lot of body bags coming back. And even in the fighting to date, stories now circulate in some circles in Russia about people being killed. The way it works is you lose a son, somebody shows up on your doorstep, said your son was lost in a training exercise in Siberia. 6 months later, someone that served with your son shows up at the doorstep and said, it wasn't like that. We were ordered to move, and next thing we know, we're getting hit with artillery in Ukraine. This is something that probably Putin cannot survive. And if he goes too far into Ukraine, it could take 100,000 people to occupy. And the Ukrainians are ready to have guerrilla war, to have sabotage, to have assassination, which guarantees a lot of body bags. So I think there's some hesitation, regardless of how much pressure Putin is in, to go immediately into Ukraine to take more territory, even though he could, just because Russia is still strong, stronger than Ukraine. But they can no longer do it at a cost. So what is Putin's play? Right now, he's doing what he can to intimidate Western Europe and saying, you have to deal with me and take off the sanctions. To this end, you have people like Pavel Falkenhauer, who's ethnic Russian, and in spite of the rather German name, and he's the main defense analyst. So he's saying Russia is planning an invasion of Ukraine in January. You have nuclear-capable armaments moving into Kaliningrad, which is the little Russian province, used to be East Danzig, that goes into to Poland. You have increasingly provocative behavior talking about prospects of nuclear war. Most analysts, and myself included, think that he's simply upping the pressure on Europe to get rid of the sanctions, and he needs that political space because the economy is going down the tube. It's one thing if you have tens of thousands of people that are not paid their salary, if the living expenses standard has gone down 10%, but what happens when you don't have the reserve fund to fill the gap? The economy will go more sharply down, and that's something that could challenge Putin's rule. Now, if he goes, I think it will not be because people come into the streets because he has a cadre. They're willing simply to shoot people. They learned the lesson of Maidan and the revolutions in Eastern Europe when too many people got into the street. But what Putin, I believe, has to worry about is what do the elite of the military, of the security services, and the economic elite collectively think? 300-400 of them, if they decide the time for him to go is soon, he's in trouble. But he may muddle through even if most of them are against him, because it takes some courage in a state like that to be the first to stick your head up. Because if just a couple stick their head up, then they're dead. You know, they're Putin is said to criticize Stalin in the following way. It wasn't necessary to kill 20 million. That's the figure generally accepted that Stalin killed, maybe some more, to have terror. You have to have targeted killings. So he has a gruesome execution of Litvinenko in Moscow. He took Anna Politkovskaya, a reporter who was covering some of the atrocities in Chechnya, and by the way, a member of an elite family, and she was killed in her elevator of her home. After she slumped to the floor, the assassin put another bullet in her brain, and this was on Putin's birthday. So this symbolism was there. Putin likes to do things on symbolic dates. So Nemtsov, former deputy prime minister, was killed in gruesome fashion walking across a bridge from the Kremlin. The message being, doesn't matter who you are, you're not safe if you oppose me. So this is the situation as it stands today, and I can expand on anything I raised or more, but maybe I'll stop for questions and see what you want to talk about.
Yeah, you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California with Herman Pirchner, Jr., President of the American Foreign Policy Council. And now we'll take some audience questions.
You mentioned before 1800, Ukraine was part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Yes.
And it was also part of the Golden Horde.
Yes.
As well. And I'm curious about what those influences, what effect those influences, historic influences, had on the Ukrainian character and yeah. Ukrainian nationalism.
I think one of the reasons that there is a cultural difference between elites in Moscow versus elites in Ukraine is the two things you mentioned. First, the Golden Horde occupied lesser time in Ukraine. And secondly, the Polish-Lithuanian Empire had a great history of democratic thought. Their 3rd of May 1791 Constitution was, next to the American Constitution, the most liberal political document in the world. And these thoughts were very alive during the time that Poland was Lithuania was occupying Ukraine. Poland never got to occupy, to put that constitution into force because of the last two partitions. But the ideas that drove that constitution were very much alive among Ukrainian intellectuals. So it's a very good question. Both things had a profound impact.
Yes, I'd like to hear about your views on American policy. What are the levers that we may have, economic, diplomatic, military, whatever, that you think we have and could use, and what do you think the next administration will and should do?
Well, the first thing the next administration should do is not visit Moscow without also visiting Kiev, because when recent trips have been made to Moscow without going to Kiev, it is disheartening for people in Ukraine, and it says we value our friendship with Moscow more than we value Ukraine and the promises we made. And I think it's important to remember those promises. Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons as part of what's called the Budapest Accord, signed by Russia, Ukraine, the U.S., and the U.K. And in exchange for giving up their nuclear weapons, those the three non-Ukrainian countries guaranteed the territorial integrity of Ukraine. So we have some more obligation to help them, not by sending troops in, but I think showing solidarity by providing defensive weapons is something we should do. Right now, Ukraine cannot even buy weapons from the U.S., and I think that's a mistake. Some people say, well, if we gave them anti-tank weaponry, because right now they can't really stop efficiently the current generation of Russian tanks, it would be provocative. Well, provocative was what the Russians did going into eastern Ukraine. And is there some risk? Yes, there's some risk. But I think there's less risk as the cost goes up for any further invasion. So I would be in favor of that also.
Just a follow-up question related to U.S. policy. My question's about the Republican Party right now. You know, San Francisco's a long way away from Washington, and right now in this electoral cycle, there's not much foreign policy discussion that is able to make it out. And considering the Republican Party's traditional policy towards Russia. Now being turned completely around in the fact that many in the Democratic Party worry that that Hillary Clinton is quite a hawk. Certainly both she and Obama have real personal distaste for Putin and have been pretty clear about what they would like to do. Mm-hmm. What do you see the future of the Republican Party itself in terms of Congress and how it can support not just Ukraine, but Moldova and of course Georgia with South Ossetia and Abkhazia?
Well, I think there's a great debate in the Republican Party between those that lean towards isolationism and those that have a more international point of view. And I don't think that debate has been resolved in the party. I think you're going to see likely bipartisan coalitions of Republicans and Democrats against other Republicans and Democrats. I think there's certainly a bipartisan consensus about the limits of force. You can't simply go into a country with guns and make a democracy where there are no small-d Democrats. So I think that's changing the foreign policy views of both parties. I do think it's very important, whoever gets in, that American credibility be restored. You know, diplomacy can work only if guarantees are believed by other countries and threats are believed. When you walk away from guarantees we gave under the Budapest Accord for the territorial integrity of Ukraine, who will accept other American guarantees? When you draw a red line in Syria, and that's maybe you should have drawn it, maybe you shouldn't, but once you draw it, you have to stand behind that threat, or else you have no credibility. And you talk about our current candidates, when you have Donald Trump saying that he's not sure he's going to stand behind Article 5 of the NATO Treaty. That's when one country has to come to the defense of any other country that's attacked. Then you really sow instability in the world, because if the U.S. won't stand behind that treaty, what treaty and what agreement is worth anything in the world? So if you want to have one thing I think the U.S. should do is to find ways to reestablish our credibility by immediately, whoever the new president is, sending high-level emissaries to let people know that this new president will stand behind commitments.
So I wanted to ask a question.
Sure.
You'll be number two then.
Hi, I'm Rahul. So my question is regarding Russia's relationship with other world bodies like BRICS. There was a summit recently.
Yes.
G20, there was also a summit a while ago, and also NATO. And how that plays into some of the Russian dynamics that you described.
Well, Russia has welcomed the British. Your question was on the BRIC countries. I think you're going to find China increasingly dominant in the BRIC structure because of its, the size of its economy. Russia is a nuclear power, but without the nukes, in many ways, a third world country. You look at their per capita income, their life expectancy, it's simply not up to the standards of the industrial world. On the other hand, you have China growing rapidly. You have India beginning to grow economically rapidly. Both countries are increasing their military might. I think you're likely to find Russia increasingly isolated within that structure. Right now, there seems to be good cooperation with China, but it's a bit of a veneer for this reason. The first treaty that China signed with a foreign country was the Treaty of Nerchinsk in 1689. That treaty ceded to China what's now Eastern Siberia and the Russian Far East. And that was China until when China was weak after the Second Opium War, Russia made two land grabs in 1858 and 1860 and took it. Till 1860, where there were no Russians in Vladivostok, for instance. China has an eye on that, and at some point, when you travel in the Russian Far East, as I have done, the general belief of the Russians is that China will come to retake their territory. So I think Russia's relationship with China is stronger. China, as it gets bigger, is likely to dominate, where it may be a little bit different, might be in Central Asia, where there's some real competition with the Central Asian states wanting to stay independent of Russia, China, and everybody else. So
a question about Crimea.
Yeah.
Turning back to the Crimean situation, where there is less Ukrainian ethnicity to begin with.
Yes.
And for which Crimea enjoyed some autonomy, politically speaking, when it was part of Ukraine.
Yeah.
Now it's not contiguous to the Russian Federation, even though Putin plans to build a bridge. What do you think the end game is regarding Crimea? It's had its territorial integrity violated. Mm-hmm. The sanctions, at least nominally, are intended to reverse Russian behavior
yes.
vis-a-vis Crimea. But it doesn't appear that, at least in Europe, there is the degree of political will that there exists vis-a-vis Russia's activities in the eastern provinces of Ukraine.
Okay. First, I'll talk about the logistic difficulties Putin has. The bridge you're trying to build is here. Right now, electricity, water, and food come through mostly through three roads coming down this way from Ukraine. Russia cannot supply directly. Originally, Russia wanted to come this way so they would have the land access to Crimea. The bridge is bogging down like all construction projects in Russia. There's even those that have strategic implications, there's a great amount of theft. You know, it's said that up to 50% of the budget allocated is siphoned out and apportioned among Putin cronies. They don't have the technology to do some of these things. They've had to lay a cable going across the strait, and where did they get the cable? They had to get it from China because they couldn't produce, for technical reasons, a cable that would deal with the currents. So their problem of supply is difficult, and that makes everything here very expensive. So the standard of living in Crimea, if you're Russian, it goes down, and if you happen to be a Tatar or a Ukrainian, or if you happen to belong to a non-Russian Orthodox church or some other religion, not too many Jewish people in Crimea, you have further problems. So people that are critical now of Putin's policy, now that they couldn't grab the whole lot, say you have to have big subsidies to Crimea. You need big subsidies in Donbass. Why is it worth it? So there's some pressure to find a face-saving way for Russia to get out. Having said that, they're also playing the other way to Europe, saying, we want to get out of the sanctions, and maybe we'll give you Ukraine the border back here in exchange for recognition of our annexation of Crimea. Right now, a European sentiment for giving Russia that deal has been going, from Russia's standpoint, in the wrong direction. And it's not strictly because of Ukraine. It has to do with what's going on in Syria, where the bombing against the civilian populations is essentially a crude form of ethnic cleansing, and also a form of ethnic cleansing that exacerbates Russia's problem with Syrian immigrants. So there is pressure on Western Europe to let up the sanctions and make the concession on Crimea, but at the moment the momentum's in the other direction.
We have a written question here. The rationale in Ukraine is the same as Hitler's invasions. Why allow Putin to do the same with Ukraine?
Mm-hmm. The reference is into 1938 in the Czech Republic, in the northern part of near the German border was a German-speaking population, and Hitler spent money with them to claim they were being treated very badly and they wanted autonomy. And then after lots of negotiations where the West essentially backed down and ignored their treaty obligations to the Czech Republic, first from France and then England, who had to defend the Czech Republic if France did. Hitler went in, and when he went in, we know the Munich conference, where essentially they let him go in. It's trying to put a half-hour lecture in about 15 minutes. But yes, there are parallels, and as a KGB man who was stationed in eastern Germany, Putin certainly was aware of the rationale for Hitler going into the Czech Republic and how he backed down the West through a series of negotiations. He'd cut a deal and then he wouldn't keep it. He'd go back and cut a deal and wouldn't keep it. And finally, when France and England cut the final deal at Munich, they didn't even permit the representative of the Czech government to be involved in the negotiations. So there is a parallel.
My concern is when I was for a few years ago, I was seeing NATO membership being offered to the various former republics of Russia, the Soviets. And I said to myself, that looks very dangerous, because I know what the United States would do, what we have done, when Cuba, Venezuela, Peru, a lot of other our own neighbors mm-hmm. went other than what we would have liked, and one could consider them to be bastions of the communist empire. We were not particularly pleasant. So when we offered membership to NATO, to former Soviet republics, and right on her boundaries, one doesn't expect Russia to be happy about that. So I have to say, I'm not surprised that there was reaction as things happened. Perhaps you'd care to comment on that.
Yeah. Well, first, I think NATO expansion is currently frozen. You can't join NATO if you have territorial disputes. So Ukraine and Georgia are automatically off the table. With regard to giving guarantees to Poland, to the Baltic states, there are other considerations too. These countries were aware of some of the speeches I talked about in Russia about regaining influence, about regaining territory. And do they have a right to defend themselves? Can they defend themselves without help? Do they not have a right to have a defensive alliance? So I would opt saying they do. And it would be, depends if you want to defend Russian imperialism or not, or if you want to impose it. And there's a debate on that, certainly. There's people of the very learned people that have a different point of view, but I was in favor of Poland being admitted and the Baltic states being admitted.
Other questions? I can think of one or two. I was wondering about the... Oh, all yeah. Right.
Can Russia really afford all this activity?
They can't. The sand is running out of the hourglass for Putin, and so far he's doubling down by being more aggressive with his diplomacy and military deployments. But at some point, there just isn't enough money to go around. And at some point, I believe the Russian elite will move to have a change of leadership in Moscow. But when that happens is a proverbial question. When's the straw that breaks the camel's back? How much can they stretch it out through gold sales or other things? But, yeah, his current path is economically unsustainable. And a thought had occurred to me about Crimea, which I visited several times. You know, it was once a Tartar Khanate, purely Muslim, and came under control of Tsarist Russia. And it had, it for a long time, a Greek-speaking population. From antiquity until World War II, you had roughly in this area Greek villages. But the Greeks wanted to get rid of the Soviets, so they were too friendly to the Nazis when they came in. So when Stalin got control of it after World War II, all the Greeks and all the Tartars were just forcibly moved in cattle cars to other places. When Ukraine became independent, the Tartars started coming in. They're about 150,000, and they're the ones that are suffering now. They had informal nonprofit organizations, a majlis, which is like a legislature, and all that now is being repressed. And one of the interesting things to me is because the Tartars have historic ties to the Turks, how this is going to be complicating Russian-Turkish negotiations. But it's a hot enough topic, especially among Turkish nationalists. So.
Yeah, in this regard, I have a question regarding the Russian-Turkish relationship.
Yes.
Because we've observed a dramatic change in the relations after the aircraft which was shot by a Turkish missile system. And
yes,
recently the relations between Putin and Erdogan improved considerably. The Erdogan paid official visit to Moscow. They expect now Putin in Istanbul soon enough. So what are your perspectives of the improvement of their relations? And how will it affect conflict in Ukraine?
On one of my first trips to Moscow, it was the last days of the Soviet Union, I was in the apartment building of a professor at MGU, that's like their Harvard. And it was a small apartment like everybody had, and midway through the evening, everybody's drinking, about 20 people. You see these two Harvard professors arguing. Next thing I know, they're on the floor slugging each other. Wow! So a couple of months later, I'm back, and they seem like they're friends. And I asked a common acquaintance, well, how do they patch it up? Oh, they disagree as much as ever. But they look like friends now. Oh, but now there's respect because each one understands the other is willing to fight. And I think part of the reason psychologically that Putin and Erdogan can talk is there's some measure of respect that prevents permits negotiation on the level of national interest. But it'll be tactical because the strategic goals and aspirations of both countries are quite different.
Yes, a question about the Baltics. Putin has been making threatening gestures against them recently. What do you anticipate that Putin is going to do, or how far do you think he is willing to go to either threaten them or actually take over portions of those countries?
Well, this is my greatest fear about Russian use of military force. The scenario is that Russia goes into Latvia, a very little country, a couple million people, substantial Russian population, by the way, many of which would rather be in Latvia than in Russia. And NATO could not stop that. So if you're a Russian hawk, you say NATO's all talk, and when all of mid-Europe and Western Europe understands that NATO's American guarantee does not protect them, then they will gravitate and accommodate to us in Russia. And because we're tough, because we can suffer more, they will have to cut deals with us to make us even richer. I don't think that'll happen, but the fact that it's discussed in Moscow is cause for concern, deep concern. One up
any more question here?
Here, in the front.
I have a question. It's a little off the subject, but there's the Kurds in this general area, and they're in parts of five different countries.
Yes.
What do you see happening with them?
Well, they're, at least in the short term, America's most reliable ally in the Muslim world. They have de facto independence, which I expect that they will keep in Iraq. And the question is, are they able to add to their territories? Iran, Turkey, Syrian government don't want to permit that to happen. But in an area where things are decided by force, I think it's not clear exactly how it plays out. But I think they keep at the minimum their independent state in part of Iraq.
More questions? I was wondering about the general economic situation in Ukraine and saying compared to the situation in Russia.
Well, Ukraine remains a very corrupt country, though they are making surprising progress on reforms, given the fact they're in a war that threatens the existence of their country. There have been reforms with the police, but you have to remember Daniel Patrick Moynihan's idea. He was a senator from New York, now dead. But he said you can't make deviant or illegal more than 10% because you can't make the whole country criminal. So the level of corruption in Ukraine has to be sliced away maybe 10% at a time, and there are signs that is happening. There are also efforts being made to make it a little bit safer with regard to foreign investment, especially for the development of shale gas resources that are in the West. It's interesting to note that Ukraine once fully developed, dependent upon petroleum products from Russia, now is independent of Russia regarding energy. So, yeah. Well, it's a long. I'll talk to you afterwards. It's a long story. Yeah.
Okay. Unfortunately, we are at the end of the hour. Our thanks to Herman Pirchner, Jr., President of the American Foreign Policy Council, for a very educational talk. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.